Good morning, and welcome to the Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. My name is Brian Howard. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book Business Magazine, and I am happy to welcome you to another great live session, our BookTrack keynote, Are You Leaving Money on the eBook Table? An in-depth look at consumer attitudes toward eBooks and eBook pricing. Now, before we get started, and if you're a webinar veteran, you've heard all this before, but this is for the newbies, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console. It's the one marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelist. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, and you can send them in at any time during the presentation. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets, bells, and whistles on this console. Speaking of which, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console. Lastly, if you leave this session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the PBV on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, October 31st, 2011. All right. Delivering today's keynote is Frank Luby, a partner at Simon Kutcher. We are beyond excited to have Frank here with us today. Please welcome Frank, who will start off with a bit about his experience and his firm.
Thank you very much, Brian. Welcome, everybody. I'm also beyond excited to be able to do this morning. Just briefly about Simon Kutcher. Our firm is the world's largest pricing consulting practice. We have offices in 17 countries around the world, and we've been at this for about 25 years. And a lot of our work since the 90s, actually, has involved media, entertainment, mobile, and digital. And that's also an area that I've actively been researching, commenting on, and also working for clients in for about that same period of time. So personally, I have been involved in doing actual pricing for digital music, for online newspapers and magazines, and also for ebooks. So there's, I think, quite a bit of background within our firm, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted to go out and talk with readers and find out whether some of the things we've been thinking and seeing really fit to what they're thinking and especially what they're thinking about moving forward. So, Brian, should we begin? Okay, well, I think it's to me.
Oh.
The title of this talk, again, is Are You Leaving Money on the eBook Table? And as I mentioned, we went out and surveyed a couple hundred readers, and we talked with early adopters, and I'll get to the reason why we talked to early adopters in a moment. But before we really get started, I'd like you to do something. I'd like you to ask yourself this question. If you surveyed eBook readers, how many do you think would say that an ebook could cost more than a print book? And I'm looking for a percentage number, and what I'd like you to do is write that number down and save it for later. In a few slides, I'll ask you to retrieve it and see how it matches up to a rather interesting insight that we got out of our survey. And now I'd like to go through the agenda, the different parts of this talk this morning. The first part is just an overview of the survey results, who responded, and what we learned. Then we'll move on to ebook usage, what readers are doing, and we'll go into some detail on that. We'll go into ebook pricing and look at what readers would pay, also at a pretty good level of detail. And to conclude, we'll talk about the future of ebooks. There's a lot of questions that are unanswered. There's a lot of questions that still matter. And I'll pose a few. I'll give my best shot at answering a few, and we might have some of those left over for the Q&A session after the talk concludes. So first of all, the survey, who responded? We spoke with or surveyed directly 246 readers who are early adopters here. It was an online survey primarily conducted for 3 weeks in April of this year. And we also wanted to look at three countries. We wanted to look at the U.S., of course, but we also wanted to get some input from the U.K. and from Germany. One of the reasons for looking at the U.K. is obviously the commonality with the language. Whatever is produced and marketed in the U.S. Obviously has a market in parallel in the U.K. What makes Germany interesting is Germany is traditionally a very print-oriented culture. Print, broadsheet, and large newspapers, daily newspapers, are still very common. It's a market that we've thought is slower to adopt e-readers and slower to adopt e-books, and we were looking for some confirmation of that. And just on the right-hand side of this page, you can see some of the breakdown. This is a pretty well-educated and affluent audience that we spoke with. Now, one of the reasons for talking with early adopters, if you think back to, you know, nowadays we take cell phones, for example, for granted. If you look at how rapidly that market has changed, we used to show a slide in the year 2000 that said two-thirds of the people on this planet have never even made a phone call. I was at a conference in April, and a panelist from Google made a comment that over three-quarters of the people on this planet now have a cell phone. So there's been a dramatic shift in how people adopt this technology and use it. What we learned with the importance of early adopters is that's where you set the price anchor points, the price reference points, and set up what you might refer to as the pricing infrastructure that will evolve over time. If you get it wrong with the early adopters, it will stay wrong for a long time. So we wanted to get their insights to make sure that what we were thinking and seeing matches up with their thoughts as well, and see how that can help us get the world of ebook pricing, which is still at a very early stage, off to the best possible start. So what did we learn from the survey? Well, what we set out to understand, some very basic questions: how readers use ebooks today, how ebook usage will evolve, which elements of ebooks people value most, and how much readers might be willing to pay for ebooks. And again, this is not we didn't talk to 2,460 people. We didn't talk to 24,000 people. So a lot of these insights are directional, but the power behind them, I think, is it matches up with a lot of things we've seen in other work that we've done. What the readers reveal to us is, first of all, ebook usage differs widely across countries. The appetite for ebooks will increase, but readers are still unsure how increased ebook usage will affect their overall reading behavior and their book purchases. That's a fancy way of saying how much print versus ebooks will be in the mix. Will people end up buying more ebooks than they will actually read? That's something that's still in evolution, but we think the indications are there that people will be more active in buying ebooks, perhaps even more so than they were in buying print books. And finally, this is a signal to work off of: a fair price for an ebook without extra features. And what we're talking about here is a direct adoption of a print book into an ebook format. A fair price came in between 64 and 70% of the print price. Good place to start, but as I mentioned, there's some other things that will come into play as you start taking advantage of all of the different and wonderful things an ebook can be. So let's look in detail now and discuss the implications this all has for ebook pricing. So next section, we'll talk about usage to start with before we get into the actual numbers and things about willingness to pay. What are U.S. readers doing? And I'll focus primarily on the U.S. readers and draw a couple of references as we go through to what we saw in Germany and the U.K. The U.S. readers have adopted faster than readers in the U.K. and Germany. They read ebooks predominantly for pleasure. They spend more on ebooks than readers in the U.K. and Germany. They rely primarily on e-readers, and that point is not as trivial as it may seem. And they think their appetite for ebooks will increase. Now, all of these things prompted even more questions on our side. I'm sure they're prompting questions on your end as well. How well does early adoption predict and secure growth in this market? How can you expand the use of ebooks for professional use? What explains the differences between these countries? What effects will tablets and technology changes, especially portability? I'm thinking ahead without actually having one in my hands yet, unfortunately, is what will the Kindle Fire do for things as well? And does the increased usage imply reading more, or does it simply imply replacing more? Replacing more means if I would have bought something in print in the past, why not now buy it as an ebook? Or will I be interested in having e-versions of some of the print books that I like? Will we see a transition that we saw, which was a big boon for the music industry back in the mid-80s, as people started converting almost one-to-one their vinyl and cassette collections into the CD format? That would create, a huge opportunity for the sellers of e-books, and it has very, very strong implications for pricing. So what we are learning, though, is print still has a strong presence. None of our respondents have eliminated print from their purchase set. They've been combining it. They combine it with audio. They've been combining it with ebooks. Some actually have gone to print, ebook, and audio. So I think this is the comments that sometimes come up with the quote unquote death of print. And I think most of us in the U.S., if we drive 15 or 20 miles any direction, we'll see a Borders that is closed. That doesn't mean that print is completely going to go away. It's a mix shift that we're seeing. Print does still have a strong presence. What we're also seeing is it raises the question, are ebooks just for pleasure? There was a small number of people who are focusing primarily on print or talking about their print usage that is mostly professional, and a slightly larger number that is a mix private and professional. Now, mostly private, what we're interpreting as reading for pleasure, predominates in print as well, but it seems like the mix is even sharper on the ebook side. They're also willing to spend. And if you break down what this chart is showing, if you look on the mix that people are spending on average, this is private versus professional. And if we take that $25 that's on this side and start splitting it up a little bit, what we're seeing is that people are spending a little bit more on ebooks than they are for print. And I think that would be the big takeaway on this, is that there is a willingness to spend. Here, this does not seem to have the same underlying logic or belief. I'll call it a myth, because I firmly believe it is one, that things that are online want to be free or need to be free or need to be inexpensive. I think people understand the value that underlies an ebook. It has a lot of intrinsic advantages, and this is a good indication for us that they are willing to make that investment and spend wisely. They also love their Kindles and Nooks, and this is when we're bringing in some contrast to Germany and the UK. The predominant form, though it's interesting that it's not even 50%, for people to read ebooks is a dedicated e-reader. And there are other ways for people to access the books and do some of the reading. What's interesting, though, here is the contrast between that red number with the 46 right in the middle versus the very low penetration in Germany and the very low penetration or relatively low penetration in the UK. It is very fascinating for me also, because you would think adoption or familiarity with this kind of technology would be a natural thing for younger people than older people. I have the good fortune of being able to interview candidates for our firm both in the U.S. and in Germany from time to time. One of the cases I take them through actually is about ebook pricing. And it startles me that some of the people applying for positions in Germany don't have enough familiarity with ebooks or e-readers to even understand or do the case. That has never happened in the U.S. So I think the U.S. is, in terms of the familiarity, what they can do and the opportunities they present, is much further along than Germany, and it appears to be also significantly further along than in the UK. Now, the little box at the bottom here says, sounds like music. And what I mean by that is the evolution of ebooks is starting to mirror digital music as hardware becomes cheaper, better, and ubiquitous. This is something I'm jumping ahead a little bit to the pricing thought, but I want to make a very important point here. As people start buying this hardware, and I don't know exactly what the rankings were, but I think it's safe to say that one of the most popular gifts in the holiday season in 2010 was something that is an e-reading enabled device. I'm not sure how many of you know that Fisher-Price and VTech have e-readers for kids who can't even read. It is becoming a very pervasive form of technology. The adoption will continue. And what we saw as people started buying iPods and then started buying iPads, and a lot of them, like me, use them as glorified iPods, they fill them up no matter what. They have them, and they won't sit empty. So when people start filling them up, especially people for the first time, this is their first encounter not only with the product and the experience with the product, but its price. And this presents a communication challenge, letting people know really how fascinating, how interesting, how versatile the ebook format is, and the fact that especially if you're living in a cold place, if you want that book, you don't need to get dressed, get in your car, drive to Barnes & Noble, and see if they have it in stock, or you don't need to go on Amazon and have it shipped and wait for it to be delivered. You can get it. You can get it quickly. That alone is a big advantage. And on the price side, that's the first price they're going to see. So you're training them to associate that perceived experience with a number right off the bat. What do you want that number to be? And I'm hoping most of you out there, especially on the publishing side, would prefer that to be a high number to start with than a low number. And that's something we'll get to, again, as we get into the details on pricing in a little bit. So another interesting facet here is that they'll read more and more. If we look on the right-hand side here, the people who are significant ebook users today, most of them would think they will read as much as they do today. 32% slightly more often, and almost half significantly more often. So this is, again, certainly directional, but it's confirmation for us that the demand and the appetite is there, and it's growing. This, in our view, presents a very big challenge to publishers on how you want to put supply up against that appetite. It begs the question here, how will publishers adjust the supply of ebooks to do justice to this growing demand in readers and in readership? And I'm not talking just about the sheer number of books, old and new, that are available in an ebook format. We're talking about sensibly evolving the format itself and enhancing it, making it more attractive, more versatile, to do a lot of things that that print simply cannot do. And so we're really talking about a brand new meaning, almost a brand new form of expression for an author to be able to use. This has, I think, even more implications on the professional or nonfiction side than it does for the fiction side. But again, you can be creative in a lot of different ways here. How will you satisfy this demand? So if we look at pricing, and we talk about what readers would pay and go into some detail on that, our first stop here is to note that there is no simple formula for pricing ebooks. And at the risk of sounding a bit testy or nasty, I get allergic to comments that the e-version of a book or an ebook, its price should be some sort of function of what the print price is for a book. That is looking at this challenge completely in the wrong way. The ebook is best understood as a separate medium, and it's also going to be over time as that mix shifts away from print and more toward ebooks, the ebook is going to be your store of value for that kind of content. It is a different product. It does different things. It has a different appeal than the print counterpart. It needs its own separately established value. And that value is not just the words on the page and the other things I can access. It's also related to the intangible benefits that an ebook provides. Accessibility, portability, transferability in some cases. We're losing, of course, the trophy value that books have. It's fascinating to watch movies from the 1980s and early 1990s and see bookshelves and albums and cassettes in the background. You don't see those things anymore. But there's so many other advantages that an ebook has. So you're doing yourself a big favor if you think of the ebook not as as a different version of something that is in print, but as an entirely separate product, which needs an entirely separate way of being communicated. It has fundamentally different value aspects than a print book. It is a really different thing. So if we look at where the money is, as I mentioned earlier, in the summary right at the beginning, respondents expect standard ebooks to cost between 64 and 70% of the print price for fair priced books. Now, fair again is open to debate. We've seen time and again, regardless of the industry, that if you stretch people a little bit beyond their perception of fair, you're not going to lose a lot of demand. So I would nudge these numbers in practice even higher. But again, it begs the question, why would you simply waste the opportunity of transferring a print book, just the words on the page, into an e-format? If we go beyond standard e-books, respondents show a willingness to pay more for e-books than print books if e-books come with attractive special features. And what we're talking about here, if we look at the U.S. number here at 70% on this page versus 64 in Germany, 64 in the U.K., what one thing that we're interpreting here is that the way that you value this product is a function of your experience with it. An ebook is an experience good. And what that means is it's hard for you to gauge your value perception of it up front, and it's a bit hard for you to gauge your willingness to pay for that up front. Once you've experienced it, and once you've used it, and you want to use it again, your perception changes, and it is a function of that experience that you have. So one hypothesis on from our point of view of why that number in the U.S. is higher is more people have had an experience, and a positive experience, with ebooks, so that they know that this is something that is worth money, this is something that is worth having. So what I'd like you to do now is go grab that number that you wrote down when we began. When I asked the question as a percentage, how many people do you think would say that ebooks could cost more than their print counterparts? And if we go to the next page, I'll jump to the number at the bottom. The answer is 56%. So I'd like to ask yourself how close you were to guessing that number. Where the 56% comes from, if we look at the middle stripe on this chart, the gray box, 38% would be interested in paying more, or saying that a print book does not have to cost less. It depends on the nature of the special features, and 18% fundamentally saying that an ebook may cost more than a print book. Now, it does come down again, and I'll say this over and over again, it does come down to the execution. What are those special features? And just as we learned in the evolution of mobile and cell phones, just as we learned in the evolution of ISPs, as they started charging for other services, and this has analogs in a lot of different places, whether it's cable television, a lot of different forms of expression and communication. How important people think these things are, these additional features, and how essential they are, is not necessarily correlated well with what they're willing to pay. So if we go to the next page, and I'll walk through some of these, I apologize that at least on my view, the headline here at the bottom is at the bottom and not at the top. But the headline says, ebook pricing, wanting it does not equal buying it. And if we look at each of the individual elements here among U.S. ebook users and planned users, what you're seeing on the right-hand side, the gray bars, is how important they think having this feature or enhancement is. On the left-hand side, the red bar, is an indication of whether they think a price premium for the presence of that feature is justified. And if you look at some of the contrasts, I think one of the biggest ones is if we go right to the bottom where it says background information. There's an interest in having supplemental detail, supplemental information that someone can access during the reading experience. Is that worth a premium? Probably not. On the other hand, if you go to, if you move two bars up where it says integrated videos or audio sequences, 23% thinking that's important, but 46% thinking that a price premium for something like that is justified. What's one takeaway from this is how do you bucket each of these aspects? And they're going to fall into three broad categories. I mean, obviously, if we went into to a lot more specifics, we could break it down further. But think of this for now in terms of three broad categories. There are some things that people are going to want that they're simply not going to pay extra for. It's a value enhancement that you will not be able to get actual dollars and cents for. So it's more of a communication challenge. You're fulfilling their expectations. You're not charging them more for it. Background information is a good example of that. There are going to be aspects that people want and feel are justified for a price premium, and this could be opportunities to learn, to do additional things, some of the things at the top that have a bit more of a professional flavor to them, that you can go into a portal and do certain things when you're in there. Those seem to be both important and valuable. Now, what's interesting about the contrast with the videos or the audio sequences is this seems to be closer to a niche aspect. And anecdotally, both with clients and also with users, I've had the same impression. I don't know how well this matches to your experience, that there are some people who find integrated video or audio sequences annoying. There's some people who find them extremely attractive and fascinating and would be interested in paying for them. Flip side of that is you can almost say they can't imagine the experience based off of the ebook platform without that material. So you can't have this broad expectation that everyone's going to like them or everyone wants this or everyone wants that. This brings segmentation, which unfortunately was beyond the scope of our study, into play here and really understanding the nature of your readers all the way down to that particular genre or for that particular author, or for that particular type of book. Is there enough people out there to support a price premium if you put these features in? If there's not, it could become a fundamental decision whether you even produce them or add them at all. You can't just expect the more that you put in, the more people are going to pay. This is not a stocking stuffing exercise. You have to really be judicious about what you add, why you add it, and whether you want to reflect that in the price premium that you might be interested in charging. So finally, if we get to the future of ebooks, what questions still matter? And there are a lot of questions that still matter. Again, we, as talking with some colleagues as we were taking these excerpts and putting the slides together, we're trying to figure out how many toes we actually suck in the water here instead of jumping all the way in to do a really deep exploration of people's habits and readership and willingness to pay. But we are happy, even with the sample we had, for the indications that we got, because they confirm a lot of things that we've thought. They've confirmed a lot of things we've seen empirically. But again, you could almost say they raise just as many questions as they help us answer. So if we talk about the future of ebooks, first let's get some food for thought. Directionally, on the left-hand side here, ebooks are growing in popularity, sales, and also innovation. A lot of creative things going on with ebooks out there. U.S. readers expect to buy an increasing amount of ebooks. Kindle sales and ebooks are expected to generate $6 billion plus for Amazon next year. They could represent 10% of Amazon's overall sales. I don't have the citation handy, but I think at one point Jeff Bezos was quoted as saying that the Kindle is the single largest individual selling product that's ever been sold on Amazon. And Amazon customers now purchase more Kindle books than all print books, paperback, and hardcover combined. So the appetite is clearly there. The shift is happening. You know, we can't be deniers of this. The question, again, is how do you take advantage of it and how do you profit from it? So what this means for publishers, again, just starting to think this through, as you increase your focus on ebook sales and the development of the ebook as a medium, how do you want to serve those segments you serve? How can you step away from that mentality that we've all had on the publishing side for years of producing this in print and taking the material that's there, the words and everything around it, that envelope around it, and rendering that in a very attractive, compelling digital format? For readers, the bundling of special features such as audio and video, trial periods, supplemental apps, we think will accelerate their shift away from print. It just becomes more natural to experience the words, the story, the information, if you're on the professional side, in that flexible format and in that expandable format that we can do in so many different ways online at the moment. And from a pricing standpoint, I think it's safe to say that ebooks may be the biggest pricing challenge you, if you're on the publishing side, have ever faced. But our suggestion is to treat this as an opportunity, and this may be the most important words, the most important sentence in this whole thing. Treat it as an opportunity to train your readers to value the new reading experience, then manage their perception by stressing the intangible benefits as well as the enhancements. I wish I could have said that sentence with far fewer syllables per word, so I'll try to take a stab at looking at it another way. Prices for ebooks right now are a work of fiction. Ebooks have no intrinsic value that leads you to a specific number. That number is up to you to assign. But you can't assign that number just naked to the product or the book or this whatever it is that you're selling. It has to be supported with teaching and communication very, very strongly. Why it has to be that number and why that's the right number for this. And the further you can start divorcing people as readers from making that comparison, well, print costs this, I think an ebook should cost this. The more you think of it as a standalone, separate entity, separate platform, separate format, the easier it will be for you to convince yourself. And we convince ourselves and our clients of this all the time. You walk through the value argument for an ebook and you think to yourself, wow, that is worth something. That is worth more. Now, will everybody pay it? No. Let's not fool ourselves. Will everyone be reading ebooks 10, 20, 30 years from now? No. There'll still be a role for print. A lot of people who read ebooks will also buy print. I'm a good example of that as well. I buy both for a variety of different reasons. But the more people have an understanding that this is a valuable, compelling experience, the more they'll be willing to pay for it. But it's up to you to train them. They're not going to do it on their own. And every opportunity you give them to see a lower price, to pay a lower price, is a wasted training opportunity. So finally, to close, some open questions from our side. Why aren't consumers able to preview full ebooks for a limited period of time before purchasing? What effect might that have? It makes us wonder a bit the struggle that iTunes had for the longest time with the length of a sample. And it was a simplistic initial natural argument for the labels to say, well, isn't listening to a sample for a long period of time tantamount to actually listening to the song? Why would we want to do that? And if you step back and think about it for a second, you know, you raise your hands. I know I can't see you, but how many of you would really want to sit down and listen to music that way? and spend your day clicking through the iTunes store, listening to three quarters of a song at a time. It sounds kind of silly, but it's really important here because the more you can tease, and I mean that in a positive way, readers to see what this experience is like, to see what these opportunities are, to see what they can do with the ebook format and how it's so much better and compelling for them, the greater chance you have of training them to pay those initially higher prices and feel good about it and want more. Am I fooling myself to thinking that prices for ebooks will stay higher than print books for a long period of time and stay there forever? No. There will always be pressure for them to come down. There'll be pressure from the resellers of them. But where you start in this journey matters. How can you replicate a bookstore experience for ebook customers? To what extent is the health of the ebook market linked to the devices? The greater the penetration, the more opportunities you have for people to fill for the first time, remember how they were trained, and use those price references and anchors the next time they go. Which genres are stronger growth categories for ebooks? That's still a bit of an open question. And finally, this is the challenge or the question for all of you out there in the audience. Are publishers taking full advantage of customers' willingness to pay a premium for ebooks? And again, standard ebook, different story. Enhanced ebook, which takes advantage of what this platform can offer, likewise different story, and it's an opportunity to go after that kind of premium. So that's what we have. So I'd like to thank all of you for your attention. I hope this was a good experience for you, may have given you a few insights you can work with, opened your eyes to a couple things, or at least raised some good questions for you. And we have an opportunity. We have some time now for some Q&A, so I'd like to turn things right now back over to Brian. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Frank. That was a lot of really great information. I'd like to remind everyone listening in that if you have questions, please feel free to submit them through the Q&A box on your console. I'm looking over the questions we got in during the session. I'm going to try to pick some good ones for you, Frank. First off, someone wants to know, as a publisher, we don't necessarily feel in control of the pricing when places like Amazon dictate what the price will be to us. How then can we train our purchasers to value our product? Do you have any insight on that?
Sure. Well, this is apparently a situation where with the pricing power that you might have as one of, if it were a large publisher and you're able to use the agency model, you've got an opportunity to set the price yourself, and Amazon would take a commission for that. This is a very tough challenge. It's a challenge that is faced in music as well. But it's a similar value story to what you lay out for customers. And I think what you also need to do is understand what Amazon's interests are and Amazon's role is in even wanting to have ebooks on its platform. And it's a different situation than it would be with the iBook store, for example. Apple sells hardware. Content goes on hardware. The more content that's available, the more attractive the hardware becomes. So if you're in the business of selling hardware to people, you want that content to be as accessible and low-priced as possible. You're interested in just moving that volume. We wonder sometimes if Steve Jobs, would he have looked back and said, gee, if I knew I was going to sell billions and billions of these things and it was actually going to be a material part of my business, would I have charged more? Would I have started at $199 and worked down from there? So I think the only way this is really going to work is to try to make these higher prices with the supporting communication, the value experience, something that is in Amazon's interest, that it's a valuable business for them as well, and frame it up from their point of view. Again, a lot of these negotiations, if we take this one level further, depend on balance of power. And the smaller your balance of power, the harder it's going to be to do this. So there's some situations where you may end up just needing to throw your hands up. But if I were going to fight that battle, I would walk in to show it's in Amazon's interest to have the prices higher, that you're doing your job to explain to people how this experience is worthwhile and justifies the price, and try to make those points clear to the team at Amazon as well.
Okay. Someone asks, best-selling e-books currently are fiction titles, not particularly innovative. What are some examples of innovative nonfiction? And also, many of the platforms don't accommodate innovative formatting. When will that change?
Yeah, I have. I'm going with the my sort of blank reaction here. When I see a question like that, and this is not the first time a question like that has come up, I think of two separate experiences. The first one is on the fiction side. Fiction titles not particularly innovative, I'll make the statement regardless of whether any of you out there are fans of what Dan Brown writes or not. But as I'm going through a print version of one of his books, I'm lost. And there's a lot of times where I'd love to have, if I'm reading Lost Symbol, I'd love to have a map of Washington, D.C. If I'm going through Angels and Demons, I'd love to have that map that Tom Hanks grabs in the movie where he said he needs a map of all the churches in Rome. There's a lot of other things I'd like to be able to look at as I'm going through this that could be built into that product. And that leads me to the answer to the nonfiction question. One example right now, it's an ebook that I do have that I've started reading, but I'm not as far along as I'd like to be. There's a book, I believe the author's name is Frederick Kempa, who's a Wall Street Journal and Handelsblatt editor over in Europe, called Berlin 1961, and it's talking about the first days of the Kennedy administration and the difficulties he had with Khrushchev. And this is an enhanced ebook which contains elements that allow you to actually go back in time, whether it's newscasts, whether it's other elements, and put yourself back into what the public might have been hearing or other information that might have been available back at that time. For me personally, that is an enhanced nonfiction experience, and I'm hoping as people become more adept at using these kinds of platforms and investing in this kind of formatting, that we'll see more of that, that people will start saying, okay, what else can we do? The only downside, my final comment on that, is a lot of this platform and infrastructure is being built from scratch. So it is a bit of a leap for someone to make that first investment and start standardizing this. It's not cheap to do some of the things I've been talking about. So I think that's kind of the catch-22 we're in. You can think of a lot of great ideas. Who's willing to be the first mover and invest and really show that you can have innovative nonfiction as well and also do a lot with fiction?
Okay. Let's see here. Someone asks, what platforms are available to sell ebooks on your own company websites and bypass places like Amazon, iBooks, Google, etc.?
Yeah, in terms of what platforms specifically, I don't have an answer for that. A comment that I do have, though, and I'll try to make my answers briefer and briefer here. This came up with a smaller music label. And they thought, you know, it would be fantastic if we could just bypass all of the resellers, just go D2C and serve our listeners that way. We've got a pretty strong community. We think we can do it. And the discussion to shoot that down that idea took about 2 minutes. Are people familiar enough with your website and its e-commerce functionality? Can you actually get that up and running comfortably? Do you want to invest heavily in actually switching people over? Because, yeah, you have a community, but most people still are buying your products, are thinking of buying your products on a place like Amazon or iTunes. So how are you going to draw them away from that? Can you imagine the communication program you would have to put in place to draw enough people over to make that the de facto place to buy your product? And the more you started going through this, people are sort of shaking their heads and going, that's a lot of work. You know, it's a dilemma. We'd love to be able to do this on our own, but realistically, you know, Amazon and iTunes are really good at what they do. And I think it's the same analogy here. Even if you got a platform in place and you could do it, the next step is to figure out how are you going to draw enough people over to your site, and how are you going to be able to convince them to stay and really make that the central way that you're selling the product. So I know that doesn't directly answer the question, what systems could you use? And it's more in the direction, is that really a path that you would want to go?
Okay. Let's see. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. If I could grab one, because I've got some visibility in the questions. There's a question that came up, and it's a very, very good one. It's about proof of the source, more e-books sold at Amazon than print. This is, to some degree, I'll say the following. There are enough examples, and I know this from the inside from publishers, that even in some unexpected cases, there are examples of higher-priced e-books, not just e-books themselves, but higher-priced e-books outselling their print counterparts. And we're not talking about niche things that sell 10 or 15 units. We're talking about volume products. So are there actual, completely precise, transparent numbers that would anchor this? At my fingertips, no. Are there enough examples that show that in a significant number of meaningful cases, ebooks outsell their print counterparts? Yes, that's certainly true. So I hope that addresses the question that was out there.
Okay. Let's see. Someone asks, they say many small publishers enter the ebook market and the gap created by agency pricing that is perceived as too high. How do you recommend small publishers help to set ebook value perception under these often antagonistic relationships?
Well, the first thing, and I think this relates to a thread that's in some of the other questions that's out there, is exactly what is it that you're selling? And it circles back to the nature of the question when we're talking about both the pricing and the future aspect. Establishing the independent value of an ebook, and not all ebooks are going to be created equal. You know, it's analogous here to thinking I make cars too. Why can't I sell my car for the same things that other people are selling their cars for? And I'd have to ask you, are you selling, little Fiats or two-door economy cars, or are you selling Escalades? And we're going to see as ebooks evolve, both in terms of genre, in terms of audience, in terms of the enhancements to them, we're going to see them evolve in the same direction. The other aspect here is, so what are you selling is the first one. And the other one is the honest question, what do you want to do? What's your objective? Are you interested in moving units? Are you interested in for using the book as a means to an end to get this in people's hands so that you can sell them other things afterwards or take advantage of that platform of users that you've created? So what role in the grand scheme of things is this product going to play for you? And if it's profit, it's a different story than if it's volume and penetration. If it's profit, I would try to take advantage of those high prices, use them as a signal or a reference point, maybe not sit right at them, depending on the product, and try to work things that way. If I'm interested in volume, I would take an entirely different view of how I would want to price. I might price lower. I might price significantly lower. And those two questions, there's no real common answer to them because they're very specific to each individual publisher, maybe even at a different point of time, and each different product. There's some situations where you're glad the prices are up there, and there's some situations where it's in your interest to distance yourself from them as much as possible.
Okay. I think you can see the questions as well. As if there's anything that's jumping out at you that you'd like to jump in on, please do. I mean, someone had asked, can you respond to the popular, quote, conventional wisdom that a standard ebook should not cost more than $9.99?
Oh, yeah. The comment on that, and I think this, I'll say two things about that. First of all, I think I've said this publicly, and if I haven't, I'm trying to make every effort to do so. One of the biggest mistakes that people make in pricing, period, is focusing in a almost knee-jerk way on one of those very convenient $99, $9.99, $19.99 levels, and thinking that that's actually a good spot to be. This is something that for a client of ours, and I can't unfortunately name the industry or even the format, that we've tested, and with in-market tests, scientifically solid with controls, we actually got a look at what the demand curves for some of these products look like. And we've seen the same curves emerge in other types of formats, and $9.99 was actually by far the worst price point to be at. As the cliche goes or the saying goes in English, it's neither fish nor fowl. It's not low enough to drive volume. It's not high enough to make money. So in that sense, in a lot of cases, it's a horrible price point. If it's chosen for communication and simplicity, it's chosen for completely the wrong reasons. It gets back again to that same thinking, what is the underlying intrinsic value here? And there's another situation where there was pressure to price a certain ebook, a new launch, at $9.99 or close to it. The product was launched in its e-form concurrently with the hardcover version at a price where the ebook was higher on Amazon than what Amazon was selling the print book for, and there was a reasonably long period of time where the ebook outsold the print book. So I think there's enough, and the more times people try this, I think the greater the body of information will grow. There's enough examples that would cast reasonable doubt on the idea that $9.99, especially right now, is in any way, shape, or form a good price for an ebook.
Okay. Is anyone talking about print ebook audio bundling, like the DVD, Blu-ray, and digital rights packages we're seeing now?
Talking, yes. Talking in terms of actually really doing this, a bit harder. And I think one of the reasons why is if you're going to bundle, the best way for bundling to work is if each of the individual elements going into the bundle, if they're sold as separate products, have their own standalone value or reference or price point. And as we're in the process right now of establishing that standalone value as richly and as strongly as possible for the ebook, I'm not sure if an attempt to bundle at the moment would alter negatively the people's value perception for the print and the other audio components. So I guess a shorter way of saying that is, in theory, it's a great idea. Will it happen someday? Sure. Is the timing right for it right now? Personally, I don't think so, because I think we've got to do a better job of establishing that standalone ebook value first, before we can start really bundling intelligently, getting the numbers right on what that bundle discount might be, and making that bundle work.
Okay. Let's see. We have a couple questions on textbooks and academic books. One person wants to know, is e-textbook priced higher than other types of books? And someone else wants to know, what's the future of academic personal ebook buys by the older demographic?
Wow, I think there's a. I'll start with the first or the last part first. And I'm not saying my experience is completely pervasive and comprehensive, but in what I've had the privilege of looking at over the last few years, the academic side of thing is probably where I see the sharpest contrast in what the questioner just asked. We've got interns here. We've got people who just graduated from college, and I've also speak from time to time with college students. And the idea of just that sentence, buying a textbook, sounds very foreign to them. You get, and I mean foreign to the point where you get, you know, strange facial expressions when you say that, or you get people sort of grinning and snickering and laughing. I think the transition is an amazing one, and one, you know, really good sign for me that a harbinger and maybe a warning sign for an educational publisher. If you're familiar with the tornado that hit Joplin, Missouri, in May of this year. I had the honor of going down there to do some volunteer work. I went down there also in September when they had their first home high school football game, and I got some background on how they rebuilt their high school. And one of the ways that they were able to affordably get a high school up and running so that they wouldn't miss the start of the school year, because their high school was completely destroyed, is someone came up with a very interesting idea. You know what? Let's skip the textbooks. Let's go textbook free. Let's take the platforms online. It's faster. It's less expensive. They don't take up any room. Let's try that as our approach. And it became one of the many elements in the whole process that allowed them to actually get to cobble together a functioning high school to replace Joplin High School, which, again, the building itself was completely destroyed in the tornado. So I think that part of that that aspect alone is a real big sign that on the educational side, do we even need the classic textbook the way we know it? And is there a digital way to do the same things much, much better and much more effectively?
Okay. I think that's about all the time we have. We have a lot of great questions still left, but I think we have to wrap things up. On behalf of Book Business, I want to thank everyone again for attending this session. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees. You can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey to let us know about your experience today. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day today. We have several wonderful sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. Remember, if you can't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. I want to thank you. Thank you very much, Frank. I think this was a great session.
Thank you very much, Brian, and thanks to everyone out there that followed this and asked questions. And this is an exciting time, and I'm very eager to see how this market evolves.
Yeah, I think we all are. Great. Well, thank you very much, and have a great day, everyone.